Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Hello, and welcome to the Latin American History Podcast. Episode 145, The Mines of Potosí, Part 5. If last episode we looked at the boom town, which the extraordinary growth of Potosí silver created, how it grew to become one of the most important and populous cities in the world, drew in people and goods from across the globe, and how these people spent their wealth on grand buildings and parties. The theme of these last two episodes in our series on Potosí is decline. There are, though, two separate declines which need to be covered. We will look at the second and decisive one next week. The first, though, comes as a result of the great mint fraud, which will damage Potosí's economy for decades. Now, this happened relatively early in Potosí's history, so it will be followed by a recovery. It is, however, an excellent story, and to understand this period, we need to look at the fraud itself. This tale reads like a 20th century thriller. An investigator pulls at a thread, which ends up unravelling a shadowy network of corruption, much more embedded and higher reaching than initially feared. This opaque system tries to stymie the truth coming to light, and thrown into the den of iniquity, the investigator sends back letters, warning that the matter is, quote, dangerous, and hinting that he's scared for his own safety. Soon he's found dead, under mysterious circumstances. Scapegoats are arranged, but whistleblowers take personal risks to get the story out, and the replacement investigator does things by the book, refusing to be cowed. What he uncovers will reverberate around the world. If I had the connections, I might even try to pitch a script based on this story to a TV studio. So this incident is known as the Great Mint Fraud of 1649, but the roots of the story go back years before that. We have seen how Potosí silver flooded every corner of the planet, and how its coins came to be seen as the most trustworthy currency in existence, with other currencies being based on it. There was so much silver in the Cerro Rico that Spanish pieces of eight were rarely questioned. Every boom town has ups and downs, however, based on how the mining which fuels it is going. That's why so many former boom towns are now bust towns. In comparison to the astronomic heights it had reached, Potosí was suffering a bit of a downturn in the years leading up to the scandal. This, however, was not widely known, partly because the reputation of the Spanish king, and by extension his empire, relied on the strength of its silver assets, and partly because there is always an unwillingness to face a problem head-on when the stakes are this high. You could perhaps make a comparison to the banks giving out those bad home loans in the run-up to the 2008 financial crisis. The economy seemed to be doing well, so nobody wanted to look closely at the riskiness of those loans. There were, however, warning signs that something was wrong, as early as a decade before, but these were ignored. While all of the implications surrounding it are complex, the heart of the fraud was quite simple. The coins which the Potosí Mint was producing were secretly being diluted with lesser metals, an act known as debasing. Sometimes in history, rulers have deliberately done this, as a last resort. It's not something that usually benefits a state in the long run, but it can make your currency go further in the short term. Now, this is a bit beyond my economic expertise, but even today, something a bit similar is done when nations devalue their currency during economic hard times. The fact that it's happening is generally known to the public. Sometimes throughout history, individuals might clip off small slivers of metal coins. This was fraud. It was done solely for the benefit of those individuals who could pass off the coins as standard ones with the same value, but keep that clipped off metal for themselves. This is basically the same principle as counterfeiting. Things are complicated today by the fact that we use paper money rather than precious metal, or even just store value in numbers on computer screens. But when a person makes fakes of a note or coin, which have no value because they're not official, but which can be passed off as real, the person has effectively made money out of nothing. What was happening at the Potosi Mint was a little bit like all of these, but it was also different. The important difference between this and government debasing is that, one, it's done in secret, and two, it's done unofficially, not by the central government. In hindsight, there was evidence that something didn't add up. Records of the amount of silver being extracted from the Cerro Rico in the 1620s show that it was falling. Yet records of how much silver the mint, which was being expanded, was turning into coins, show the number of these coins going up. Occasionally merchants in Spain, as far back as the early 1630s, complained that they had been given Potosí coins, which didn't contain the full amount of silver. Enough instances of this occurred that the king sent the Peruvian viceroy to investigate, but he concluded that it must have been done in error and on a very small scale. Now, this was conceivable. So many coins were being produced that it was impossible to check them all. There was a person called the assayer whose job it was to perform quality control and check a fraction of the coins, returning those that weren't good enough to be re-minted. Slave labour was used in the mint, and so it was very easy for the authorities to believe that either mistakes were being made through incompetence rather than dishonesty, or that if there was fraud taking place, it was on a very low level individual scale. Slaves are very easy to suspect and blame because of their low social status. Another reason for institutional hesitance to start poking around in the management and government of the mint and the city of Potosí was that war of the Basques and Vicuñas we talked about last episode. The major spark of that conflict had been the hoarding of power through political positions and mining wealth along ethnic lines. An uneasy truce had been called with a slightly better shared balance of power. However, peace was a wobbly structure. If important people were found to have been abusing their positions and needed to be removed, the fear was that the structure might just topple. By the beginning of the 1640s, people around the world were beginning to notice the problem. In 1641, the ruling councils of Genoa in today's Italy and the city of Antwerp in today's Belgium decided to refuse to accept Potosí coins, because they felt that they couldn't be trusted. A couple of years ago, the BBC made a really good series about the Brinks Mat heist, which happened in London in 1983, and is to this day the UK's biggest ever gold heist. Although people were found guilty, the vast majority of the staggering amount of gold stolen was never found, and the series ended by saying that once it found its way into the system, it was impossible to recover. If you live in Britain and possess any gold jewellery that wasn't made before 1983, the show said, there is a good chance that it contains a bit of stolen Brinks Mat gold. By extension, by now it can be found in jewellery across the world. And so by the 1640s, debased Potosí coins would have been everywhere, given how they underpinned global trade. The bankers of Genoa were important funders of the Spanish crown, and so a second viceroy was sent to investigate. He reported that he had found evidence of individual Potosí merchants forging coins using the mint, but he encountered resistance from the chief magistrate of Upper Peru and concluded that fixing the problem would be difficult because, in his words, since the interested parties in these inspections are the said merchants, and they are so thick with their informants and dependencies, when they perceive an exemplary punishment, they leave for free, without charges, and everything is facilitated, and the damages remain in the same state, or even worse. 2 years later, another inspection took place, but the man leading this one had quite a lot on his plate at that moment, and his work at Potosí came to nothing. It was around this time that Francisco Gómez de la Rocha started to rise to prominence. Rocha was an Extremaduran who had come to Potosí about 5 years earlier and had made a living trading in coca leaves. Now he made the jump into silver, becoming one of those merchants that quote I just gave was referring to and gaining access to the use of the mint. By 1644, he had gathered enough power to be appointed a town magistrate and a captain in the military. So at this point, he was Potosí's richest man, and he had control over soldiers. Clearly debasing in Potosí predated Rocha, but he seems to have industrialized it. He diluted the coins with copper, keeping the resulting excess silver for himself, and the locals had even begun referring to these reddish-colored coins as rochunas, learning to recognize and reject them. What's more, he invited political allies to get in on the act themselves in return for their support, in a kind of client-patron favor arrangement. Again, like with that Basque-Vicuña war, it brings stories of the mafia to mind. A new investigator was sent, named Blas Robles de Salcedo. He found a city where the corruption was so entrenched and the secret so wide known that it was very hard to simply sweep it under the carpet. Yet this is what he clearly felt under immense pressure to do. Rocha was reorganizing his army to send them to reinforce Chile, and he himself was putting up the money to fund it. This show of physical power would have been obvious to Robles.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
What's more, Rocha was even lending money to the king himself. You can't really ask for a more powerful bargaining chip and connection than that. Robles wrote cryptic letters to the viceroy in Lima, talking of dark, shadowy forces, and saying that this was, quote, a dangerous matter. He even hinted that he would quite like to be replaced, instead of continuing to investigate. He sounded scared. On another occasion, he wrote that almost the entire guild of merchants and lenders in the mint are involved. Unfortunately, there's a bit of a gap in the record here. I can't find much about Robles' time in Potosí or what exactly these mysterious circumstances were. But in 1646, it was in mysterious circumstances that he was found dead. There have been a few institutionalized scandals in the news in recent years, where blind eyes have been turned towards powerful figures, and they have been allowed to continue doing what they were doing. When someone is embedded into the upper reaches of those institutions, fear, both personal for those who might try to take them on, and institutional for the damage exposure would do for the reputation of that institution seems to work to keep things quiet. Eventually, though, a point is reached where the reputational damage from doing nothing becomes greater than it would be from revealing the problem. By 1648, this point had been reached. The international distrust of Spanish silver was starting to have serious consequences for the crown and its economic solvency. Tests done on Potosí coins in Spain found that instead of just a few, lots and lots of them were deficient in silver. Those pieces of eight, designed to have enough silver to value 8 reales, were in reality more like pieces of 5. This time, the investigations would be serious, and the man chosen for the job was an ex-inquisitor who approached the job with a religious zeal. His work was still dangerous. While he had more support from higher up, he was still in a precarious position. His name was Francisco de Nestares Marin. The year before, a corrupt councillor had arrested the man in charge of inspecting silver ingots at the mint and making sure that the flawed ones were remade to meet the required standard, the assayer. Being in on the scheme, the assayer was of course failing to do his job. Perhaps the councillor wanted to make him a scapegoat so that the fraud could continue. Or perhaps they had become enemies. Apparently rivalries had started to form between Rocha's allies. Either way, this was a mistake, and instead of satisfying Marin that justice had been done and the culprit had been found, it spurred him onwards. Over the following few years, Marin and Rocha played a chess-like game of intrigue. Marin summoned people for questioning and observed production in the mint. Rocha bribed and threatened workers with knowledge of the fraud, or blackmailed those he had made loans to. Potosí's government even ran gambling houses, which provided leverage over all sorts of people, which could be used to keep them quiet or to force them to do their bidding, because Rocha controlled the local government. Marin faced death threats. Effigies of him were burnt in the main square as warnings, and bullets were fired through the windows of the office in the mint from which he was conducting his investigation. On top of all this, while clearly the king wanted the problem solved, he did not want any disruption to the flow of silver. Marin had to ensure that his investigations did not stop the city from producing. Slowly, though, those involved at the lowest level were uncovered, and this then led Marin to people higher and higher up. Some of the mint slaves, who had been thrown under the bus, testified that the inspections that were recorded to have taken place had not in fact happened. Rocha's allies began fleeing the city, and in 1649, Marin had enough evidence to have him and the assayer hung for orchestrating the fraud. Warrants were issued for many others, but by this point they had all escaped. Officially, the investigation continued until 1660, when Marin died. If finding the source of the problem and dealing with it was difficult, cleaning up afterwards was equally problematic. Trust had to be rebuilt in the reliability of Spanish currency, and you couldn't just go back to minting the coins with the correct amount of silver, like nothing had ever happened. It took until 1652 for new coins to return to having the full weight of silver. And of course they had to bear new designs, so that they could be differentiated from the old suspect ones. In the meantime, as many coins as possible were recalled to be dealt with. This was a monumental task. The supply of currency dropped dramatically while all this was happening, and this had all sorts of knock-on consequences. Mexico was the other large producer of coins, and so, through no fault of its own, its economy was disrupted, because the coins had to be recalled. Just finding the coins was difficult, as they were scattered across the globe. In the Mughal Empire, they were melted down and made into rupees. Some who possessed large amounts of them decided to at least recoup some of their losses, and decided to sell them at reduced rates to smiths, who would extract the silver and use it for other things like jewellery. The recalled coins, which made it back into Spanish official hands, were assessed for purity. Some were so impure
that they were simply tossed aside. The bulk of them were devalued and re-stamped to signify this. For that intermediate period, until 1652, they would be worth 7.5 reales instead of the full 8. These coins became known as rodases, contrasting them to the rotunas. After 1652, when the full value coins were produced again, both became a legal tender. One of the day-to-day observations you might encounter in Latin America today is that often it can be difficult to find change. Sometimes shopkeepers are reluctant to take large notes and give away all their change, or they simply don't have it, so you can't buy the thing you are after. I don't really know why this is. Presumably it's something to do with the ratios between the different notes and coins not being very well organized. You can't just print more though, because printing money is supposed to lead to inflation. There is a difference then between not having a valuable enough currency and not physically having enough currency, if that makes sense. In this period too, many of the frontier and underdeveloped Spanish provinces suffered from a physical lack of currency. You might be a landowner, producing large amounts of valuable crops which people wanted to buy, but that didn't help if there was no currency to buy them with. Apparently, these regions were also particularly likely to be chosen as a place to send the bad coins before the fraud was uncovered, as the scarcity there made them less likely to be examined. People wanted whatever coins they could get. The recalling of the currency, combined with the devaluation, caused problems in these regions. Currency became even scarcer. The devaluation also meant that some wage labourers struggled. The drop in value of the money which their wages were paid in had a similar effect to high inflation. Suddenly they were being paid much less, and it was harder for them to buy anything. There were riots in southern Spain because of this. On an individual level, people all over the world found themselves with useless coins. If you've ever discovered that a note you have is fake, you know this scenario. Nobody will take it, and so what you thought had value now has none. This is annoying if it's a £20 or a $20 note, but it's a real problem if much of your cash wealth is tied up in a few bogus coins. Potosí coins never recovered their credibility in Asia. Governments and merchants refused to accept them, even once all this action had been taken. The Asian economy contracted because suddenly there was a lack of currency. Although coins stamped with an M for Mexico or an S for Seville were accepted, there were nowhere near enough of them. For Potosí itself, all of this was a disaster. Many, many mining and smelting operations went bust, and as always in boom towns, which owe their existence to the extraction of a valuable commodity, this had a knock-on effect on everything else. All of the bars, hotels, food and transport providers which existed there relied on supporting those working in the silver industries. When those miners and smelters disappeared or could no longer afford to pay for these services, the other industries suffered as well. People left town penniless, while others moved out to other much smaller finds on the Bolivian Altiplano, hoping to be the one to strike the next big find. Marin tried his best to mitigate all this, but was unable to. As we know from our own times, hard economic circumstances can be difficult for the majority, but a few can do very well during them. One man, Antonio López de Quiroga, who was originally from Galicia, is a perfect example of this. He managed to invest wisely and weather the storm, dying in 1599 as Spanish America's richest man. It took decades for things to start to turn somewhat back to normal, but eventually they did. The amount of silver the mountain produced would never go back to what it had been before, but it did start rising again in the 1730s. The high had been so high that even during this low, Potosí was still of global importance. In the next and final episode in this series, we will look at how Potosí declined for good, the mine's post-colonial life, and the time between then and the present-day form I found it in. If you've enjoyed this episode and want to do something quick and easy to help out, one thing that's really useful is leaving a review wherever you get your podcast from. A huge thank you to everyone who's already done this. And thank you to all of you for listening.
You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast, written and recorded by me, Max Argent, edited by Alex McNamara. If you've enjoyed the podcast and want to get access to extra episodes, you can become a friend of the podcast. There's information about how to do this in the episode description. The podcast is also available on YouTube by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. If you'd like to send me a message, or if you have any questions, you can email me at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.